on your study guide, but it's from Isaiah chapter 46, and beginning in verse 8. Remember this and be assured. Recall it to mind, you transgressors. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God, there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, things which have not been done, saying, my purpose will be established, and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Calling a bird of prey from the east, the man of my purpose from a far country, truly I have spoken, truly I will bring it to pass. I have planned it, surely I will do it. This is the word of the Lord. In this passage, of course, we hear the Lord saying to us that He is the unique one, the one who is sovereign over time, that He creates all things, and when He creates all things, He creates them with particular ends in mind, and that He oversees those processes in history which take things towards their appointed ends. This evening, we want to take up the contrary view, which is atheism. And when we come to the creed, we confess our faith in God. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, the Apostles' Creed says. And in the Nicene Creed, we say, I believe in one God, Father Almighty. So the Christian confession begins with the belief in God Himself. This is, of course, something which is coming under increasing salt in this age of skepticism. And it is fueled not only by ignorance with regard to those who have held to belief in God through history, but also by the desire, I fear, in some quarters, to maintain the appearances of intelligence and being fashionable and even being acceptable. We live in times when, I think for evangelical and Catholic and Orthodox Christians, the next 20 years will probably be seasons of clarifying demarcation, which is to say that while there will be increasing numbers of people who do become Christians, what it means to be a Christian is something which will become more culturally difficult to maintain. I think the lines in the culture, and I think these are already drawn in many ways in the academy and in politics, are going to be more clearly and, in some cases, more challengingly made. That being the case, a clear examination of our own faith, what it is we believe and why we believe it, is something which is necessary for our time. There are a whole hosts or varieties of kinds of atheism, and it is made popular and fashionable in some quarters by what you might think of as pop atheists, people like Sam Harris or the late Christopher Hitchens. And it is also promoted through the kinds of subtle undermining of the credibility of the church in the writings of, say, and I've mentioned this before, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, about which David Bentley Hart wrote, it is the most lucrative novel ever written by a borderline illiterate. I do appreciate David Bentley Hart. And if you ever get a chance to pick up Hart's The Beauty of the Infinite, I hope you will, along with his book, Atheist Delusions. There is silly atheism, the kind that the supposedly brilliant Sam Harris offers in his books. I think he's one of the worst atheists going, because he makes really absurd statements, like the Bible was written by sand-strewn men and women to whom a wheelbarrow would appear as an advance in technology. That kind of cultural arrogance with regard to ancient Near Eastern people wouldn't stand up in the academy for even 15 seconds. But there are people who will read it, read these kinds of things, and think that supposedly they have credibility. There is despairing atheism. It's the kind embraced by those who are so overwhelmed by senseless violence and horror that belief evaporates. You see this kind of temporary atheism in the lives occasionally of people who encounter great sadness, the loss of a child or the loss of a spouse to a seemingly random event, the rape of a daughter, or just simply seeing the sheer level of human suffering in a place like Calcutta, or a violence-strewn battlefield, anywhere in history for that matter. The rise of atheism in Europe in particular was fueled by the battlefields of World War I, by the immense suffering that took place there and the wholesale slaughter of human life. Now, of course, atheism wasn't the only response. There were other soldiers that fought in the trenches, men like Tolkien and Lewis, who came away with a different vision of what they'd encountered. But it is nevertheless true that there are many people who at least have a temporary atheism due to the level of suffering that they see, and what they hold to be a somewhat inept or perhaps anemic response of Christians to the problem of such violence, philosophically and financially and physically and emotionally. There is, of course, also philosophically sophisticated atheism. I think Daniel Dennett has some philosophically profound arguments to try to make for atheism. And there's also the entertaining atheism, the kind that's enshrined in the words of the immensely witty but late Christopher Hitchens and George Carlin. I grew up with George Carlin. One of the great privileges I had as a 9-year-old is if my grandmother let me stay up long enough when I stayed at her house to see Johnny Carson's monologue. So he was the first evangelist I listened to on a regular basis. And of course, I loved Carson when he had George Carlin on. Now, Carlin, of course, a great atheist. And Gervais, the contemporary comedian, Ricky Gervais, right now sort of fills that comic role. But perhaps both Hitchens and Carlin now more accurately are aware of the nature of things. There is, of course, as well, violent atheism, the kind that seeks to overthrow any vestige of faith in the name of progress. Zola wrote, "Civilization will not attain to its perfection until the last stone from the last church falls on the last priest." I think it would be good for us to understand right at the outset where atheism takes us, because atheists have their profound philosophical problem to present to Christians, which is the problem of God's omnipotence and human suffering. But the great philosophical problem that the atheists face is the construction of an ethic which is going to preserve the dignity of man. To that end, certain atheists have decided to give up the fight and simply say that there really isn't any particular dignity associated with the human species. And one of the most profound writers in that vein is Peter Singer, the ethicist at Princeton University. And I wanted to read you tonight some of the things that he's written, because I think it's vital for us that we take things kind of out of the philosophically abstract, almost Platonic realm of thought and bring it right back down to here where we kind of live, move, and have our being. Singer, in talking about human life, writes, "At this point, we should pause to ask what we mean by terms like human life and human being. These terms figure prominently in debates about, for example, abortion. Is the fetus a human being is often taken as the crucial question in the abortion debate. But unless we think carefully about these terms, such questions cannot be answered." So he goes into a rather lengthy discussion here then about what constitutes a human being. There are two senses of human being. The one proposed by Joseph Fletcher, a prolific author on ethical issues. And he talks about how these different senses affect a profoundly intellectually disabled child or a newborn infant. The newborn infant, the profoundly intellectually disabled child, these are indisputably members of the species Homo sapiens, but they are not self-aware, have a sense of the future, or have a capacity to relate to others. I find it astonishing that someone would assert that an infant has no capacity to relate to another person. This guy spent way too much time in the library and not